This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
It is the WrestleMania week edition of Pollock and Thurston. I am John Pollock in Toronto this weekend, joined by Brandon Thurston, who will be in Buffalo this weekend, as we will be following from miles away as the WWE stages its multi-night affair, its takeover of Las Vegas and all surrounding areas, with about 5,000 events that they have staged, everything from WrestleMania to the roast of WrestleMania.
Don't forget about WrestleMania After Dark.
Yes, After Dark. Which usually I've never quite understood, like, for these late night events. Like, it is actually dark at this time.
Gronk is going to be there.
Oh,
DJ.
And we're not going. What night were we supposed to be at WrestleMania After Dark?
We're not going, which is going to be a significant effect on the economic impact in Las Vegas, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine, like, that pan shot of the Fountain Blue, everyone's just partying it up, and then you and I are there in the corners with, like, a bottle of water and a notepad.
Yeah.
That would
you're scribbling with a pen, longhand.
Well, we are going to be getting into all things WrestleMania, and if there wasn't enough to discuss, I had a laundry list of topics written up yesterday, and then today about 5 hours of interviews with Nick Khan and Paul Levesque dropped. So I was unable to book Nick Khan this week, but we are going to have Nick Khan in spirit on this show, just as we promised last week, and we will be talking about both of these interviews that are were on The Ankler, which was a this was at NAB recently with Paul Levesque and Nick Khan in Vegas, and then on the Bill Simmons podcast, his outlet of choice. Went to the man's house, no less. I mean, I know it's tough crossing the border, but we could have had Nick Khan come down.
I am in your house studio right now, for all you know. They did a split screen just like we're doing right now. And
imagine this and bar. I guess in the middle comes down, and it turns out Brandon is actually to my right in real life this time. So we'll get into all of that. But let us first focus on WrestleMania and the biggest question. How profitable of a weekend is this going to be for WWE and TKO? And Brandon, is this a very safe assumption that this will be the largest generating WrestleMania of all time?
It would be surprising if it did not break the real-time dollars gate record, which was set last year. We can quickly go through the WrestleTix data, which will change, but the latest count from WrestleTix for night one is well over 51,000 and change. For night two is 53,000 and change at the moment. That's tickets distributed. I found this map that shows the ticket prices. However, there's a lot of dynamic pricing, I'm sure, that's happening on Ticketmaster. On the secondary market, you can currently get in for $149 for night one. You can get in for $275. Night two is really the more expensive night, again, as I think it was last year. On Ticketmaster itself, you can get obstructed viewing for $140, but the standard ticket is $190. For night two, it's more expensive, $210 and $300. Tickets are expensive, just to what we're trying to express there, and that's going to greatly influence the calculation of what the gate is going to be. Last year, the gates, not including fees, which are one of our favorite topics, with or without fees. Okay, without fees, this information came from the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission last year, because it was in Philadelphia last year. $18.4 million was the gate for night two without fees. Figure I tack on, I don't know exactly what the number was with fees, but if you figure you tack on like 6 or 7%, it gets up to almost $20 million, just under about $19.7 million. And that would be the real time, all time professional wrestling gate record, because it would be well ahead of the $17.3 million with fees that we know that WWE, by its own press release, got for WrestleMania 32 in 2016. Night one, if you're interested, was $17.7 million, maybe somewhere around $18.8 million with fees. So for them to break the all-time record, not just in real-time dollars, which would be, again, which would be $18.4 million or $19.7 million, something like that, with fees. If you adjust for inflation, and if you've been watching the news, you know, if you've been living life in the United States, in fact, you know that inflation has been a big deal in recent years. So adjusted for inflation from 2016 to today, they would need to hit $23 million. So that does seem possible, though, because ticket prices are, by everyone's impression, a lot more expensive than they were last year. Just to break the real-time record, the average ticket price would only need to be $350. I would say that's a safe bet. I would assume that it's quite a bit higher than that. And so to break the all-time record, adjusting for inflation, and this is for either night, and both nights individually might do it, the average ticket price would need to be about $422, I think, and that's without fees. So that would get them to $23 million. And remember, of course, this is a two-night event, and you just multiply that by two, we could be seeing a gate. If both nights break the real-time record, we'd be looking at a gate that's close to $50 million. I can estimate it up to like $49 million here, and that's just with the bare minimum that they would need for each night to become the number one and number two highest gate ever, adjusting for inflation. Getting very close to the Saudi Arabia site fee there.
So the last number of tickets distributed from WrestleTix, this had come out on Tuesday, is where things stand. So for night one, it's at about 51,300, just over that number. And then for night two, right at around 53,000 tickets distributed. So it's not a case where they are at capacity yet at Allegiant Stadium. And I think a lot of that has been looked upon. You know, you have heard, like, at least anecdotally from people that have both been, you know, there have been exorbitant prices to get into WrestleMania. On top of that, the lure of WWE this weekend was that traditionally Easter weekend is a pretty dead weekend in Las Vegas, and that is something you are contending with as well.
But
that
no said, Final Four. Nick, I can hear Nick Khan in my head. No Final Four to compete with, though.
Yes, he would rather compete with the Easter Bunny than he would with Duke or whoever. But I will be like, you look at the numbers from last year, and it seems like they will be right in line just in terms of numbers, that you could very easily imagine 60,000 people inside of Allegiant Stadium by showtime on Saturday and Sunday night when you figure in comps. And that's not even taking into security guards, vendors, and anyone with a pulse.
Security people outside, the people next door. No, they have been, for the most part, they have been announcing numbers that are similar to estimate to distributed from WrestleTix.
Did you hear what happened on Monday?
It was Michael higher.
Cole
that happens sometimes,
announced a lower number than...
Oh, lower. That's what I meant. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. And that happens sometimes. I mean, last year, WrestleTix estimated, I believe, the same number, roughly the same number, if not exactly the same number, 70,000 for each night. And I can't get to that with the data from Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission. So it's just the nature of analyzing those ticket maps.
Yes. Unfortunately, not as transparent of a commission, which is funny because I remember, like, especially in the mid-2000s, when every UFC pay-per-view would occur. This is like the mid-2000s. And like clockwork, I would reach out to the Nevada Athletic Commission. They would not just get me information. They would fax me everything.
They would fax you?
They would send me a fax. This was like 2005. They were in 2006.
Okay.
They would fax me. I got like the medical information, the gate, paid comps, everything you could imagine. Because Nevada, man, were they easy to deal with. But
they don't sanction wrestling.
They don't. There was a time that Nevada was overseeing pro wrestling, including Hulk Hogan going into this on the WrestleMania 9 documentary, if you like your fan fiction. But no, does not oversee professional wrestling. So it would not.
And they have a slap fighting section here on their website, I see.
They have sanctioned slap fighting, yes. But not as a, they do not now, they're not as transparent when it comes to MMA information as they
once were.
That's the power of TKO. We should also note that the fact that this year you, number one, have the Las Vegas Authority, some acronym that is much longer than I can recall off the top of my head. And this, the sheer size of events, like they have this agreement with the Fountain Blue, which is the official hotel where they're doing the WrestleMania Dark after each night. They're doing the Hall of Fame, the Undertaker show, the roast of WrestleMania, like all these supplementary events, the world that they have set up there. I mean, the taken of revenue over these next couple of nights, which even extend to next week. We have Raw in Vegas. NXT is in Vegas. I mean, it's going to be an enormous amount that they are taking in when you factor in all of these additional events that they're staging, even compared to last year and the scope of what WWE is doing in the host city.
And let's not forget, so Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority,
of course,
is the entity that attracted WWE to do WrestleMania in Las Vegas, snatched it away from Minnesota, apparently, according to my reporting, through public records requests. And remember, $5 million is the site fee that they're getting, according to the records that I obtained back in July. And that article has been tweeted in recent days, too, if you want to reread it. So it's going to be, you know, a lot of money for them, for sure. It's a site fee that's $5 million. And that's about the standard rate for WrestleMania, you know, compared to other years, although they're going to get a $7 million, just over $7 million site fee, apparently, for SummerSlam in New Jersey. That's this year, the two-day event, which is something I still don't understand why they're getting so much money for. But it'll be, you know, it'll be ticket sales, a lot of ticket sales for all of their events. Don't forget the Tony Hinchcliffe roast, the Undertaker one-man show, the After Dark stuff, the Hall of Fame and all that, and tens of millions of dollars to some degree for WrestleMania 2.
Stand and deliver. We've also
stand and deliver
at T-Mobile with a 10 a.m. local start time. So what better way to kick off your day if you're a wrestling fan than getting to an arena at 9 in the morning?
Yes.
That looks very exciting. I also wanted to talk just a bit about, because Brandon, in the past, you've always visualized this for us when it comes to sort of the history of WrestleMania and its gates, and just looking at how WrestleMania has grown over the years. And you can break down WrestleMania into phases. There was the initial 4 years where closed circuit was a major factor in addition to the live event experience. Pay-per-view was in its extreme infancy, but by WrestleMania 3, it's a pretty dominant way for people to still watch the show, unless you were in Michigan where it was blacked out. Then we're pretty much into the strict pay-per-view era, which would last from, you know, the late 80s all the way up until the WWE Network era, which the first year is 2014. And I still remember as everyone was in the WrestleMania press box, and the next day they were going to hold a earnings call,
yes,
and announce the vaunted number. How many people ordered the WWE Network for that first weekend? Would there be buffering issues? What would happen? And it was a number, I want to say 667,000, roughly, in that neighborhood. It was like
sub 700. Yeah, for Q2, that's what they did. I have 665 here. But they did, if you remember, in the first couple of years, they would do a special conference call, not a quarterly earnings call, but they would do a special conference call just to disclose the post-WrestleMania number, because it would be the day in the year where the number would be the highest. And that's what they did for the first couple of years there.
Yeah, in that first year, like it wasn't a banner number, but there was also still a lot of people that spent money on pay-per-view that probably, yes, just did not have confidence in the technology for the big show of the year. And by the following year, I mean, you were starting to see the migration more and more towards the WWE Network, and they came up with all these gimmicks to just juice that number as much as possible. The idea that you could watch WrestleMania for free with all of their trials, and really the network era, it peaked at that 2018 show with Ronda Rousey's debut, where they got as high as, what was the number that they got to, about 1.8 million?
The peak, yeah, I would have to look up what the peak was post WrestleMania, but in 2018, their peak on a quarterly average worldwide was 1.8 yeah. million subscribers.
I feel
worldwide.
They exceeded 2 million for the day, yes, of WrestleMania. Yes. That was the peak. And then within 3 years after that, that is when we go into the Peacock era, where they start to license it elsewhere. And next year, it may be a whole new era where it is still Peacock US, but internationally for most of us, it will be viewed on Netflix this year.
Yeah, and just to illustrate how much people were still buying it on pay-per-view after it had already gone to the network. So in 2014, that's the first WrestleMania after the network launches. And it's just a few months, and they go from in the prior year doing 1.1 million buys worldwide. Or maybe we should just concentrate on the U.S. because it had only been launched in the U.S. at that point. But in the prior year, no network yet, 662,000 buys. The following year, the network has been around for a couple months, and they still do 420,000 buys. So it's not like it was completely cannibalized. It was certainly not down to zero, and we still had buys coming in for the B pay-per-views as well. And even by 2015, you still got over 100,000 people in the United States ordering the pay-per-view through traditional pay-per-view and paying, you know, what, 10 times the price.
Even when JBL and Michael Cole would literally scold you on air for...
You must be stupid. Yeah.
Who would buy this on pay-per-view? It was absolutely surreal. Michael Cole doing his breakdowns of how to order the WWE Network. I mean, it was how-to videos.
Those were primitive days where you had to get a streaming service on your television.
Yeah, it was quite remarkable.
It's like Netflix, but better.
That's right. That's right. It's like Netflix, but better. And all these years later, it is Netflix now. Thank God. That will be, as much as we focused on the AEW rights last year, I mean, it will start to ramp up, and next year with the streaming rights up, they will expire. Correct me if I'm wrong. March of next year. So we'll be about
under 1 year now. Yes.
Yeah, so literally, they could not have timed this better. I'm sure that was not a coincidence for next year's event in New Orleans, that we will see if they move their streaming rights or Peacock makes a big, big pitch to retain what's still significant programming for Peacock on a monthly basis.
Based on the vibes I got from Richard Deitch last week, not that he knows definitively, but that I would think that that the value for NBCU to Peacock of having those rights has diminished over time. It was more important at the beginning of this 5-year deal to get people to adopt Peacock, but now they've either got it or not, and maybe it's not so dependent on whether or not WWE's on there. And I would think Netflix would love to have the domestic rights worldwide, and would love to have the domestic rights to add to the worldwide PLE and library rights that they have.
And let's not forget how all of this sort of is in the same under the same umbrella, is as we are speaking today on Wednesday. Today is the first day since the exclusive negotiating window has closed between ESPN and the UFC. So they are now free to welcome all bidders to the table. So they're negotiating the UFC domestic rights. In time, they're going to be sitting down to look at these WWE streaming rights. And you've got to the side this TKO boxing model that Nick Khan did drop in the Bill Simmons podcast that there should be some news on that front in 4 to 6 weeks. All of these things, you have to imagine, are going to be brought up among these different suitors that you are talking about, and various packages and things that they can offer across all of their entities in the combat sports realm.
Netflix is interested in boxing, clearly, from their experimenting with the Jake Paul and Mike Tyson fight. Yeah.
So a lot to unpack over the next couple of months when it comes to this. But yes, this is sort of just a snapshot at where WrestleMania stands this coming weekend. And we do look forward to seeing any live reports that come out of the roast of WrestleMania. I think that might be the low-key curiosity event.
I was going to go, that's the main event to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you think any of this ever sees the light of day?
No, but clearly there's going to be people who will relay what happened, if anything notable happens.
Because if I was Netflix, I would, like, maybe you could clean it up afterwards, but it's like, to me, this is like prime content that Netflix would want. It's like Tony Hinchcliffe, who is one of our major comic stars on our platform, and WWE together. It's like, I think they would make a big push for this. This is the streamer that absolutely wanted that Mr. McMahon series out. So, hey, all goes hand in hand, but we will be talking a little bit more about that Mr. McMahon series to come. Well, let's move on. Today was Nick Khan Day on the media front. So we had two interviews that dropped. We're primarily going to focus on the interview that he did with Bill Simmons. So he has had some memorable chats with Bill Simmons. The one that I constantly go back to is his January 2023 appearance with Bill Simmons. This was when Vince McMahon subtly elbowed his way back into the company, back into power. So Vince was riding tall in January of 2023, and Nick Khan famously explaining that, you know, he had some problems. He did what you do in that time. You go away, and the public likes that. And now he's back. Anyone who thought he was actually retired doesn't know Vince McMahon, doesn't know, you know, he was never gone. He was never going to be gone, and he's back. But then he was gone again, and nearly gone was this Netflix documentary that Bill Simmons has stated was the toughest thing he has ever worked on in his career, was trying to get this thing out of the gate and premiering last September, which if you are strictly taking in your wrestling through WWE, you would never know this Mr. McMahon series existed or was on your partner of potentially the next two decades to come. So that is how this interview started. And here is Nick Khan speaking a bit about the Mr. McMahon series and how it was viewed internally after its release.
Episodes 1 through 5, it was all fine.
Yeah.
And then, you know, episode 6 obviously had a lot of, you know, tawdry allegations in there. So, you know, the most important thing at the company was, hey, this is not for us to spike it. That's not what the deal was. And the deal that was struck with Netflix was prior to me joining WWE on a full-time right. basis. So it was sort of trying to help everyone stay calm who was watching it. And hey, we'll get through this thing and get to the other side of it, which hopefully, you know, now we are.
What was the kind of, what kind of feedback did you get from people on it?
It went everywhere from, hey, it was phenomenally done, like you did with Andre, the giant documentary on HBO Sports, to, oh my God, you know, this thing, you know, it's not true. It's not factual, you know, this and that. There were people who loved it, as an objectively told profile of a person.
Yeah.
And people who were close to the subject who didn't like it, which, you know, I understand, and I would think you understand.
Yeah. It was, it certainly ran the gamut of emotions. I was really proud of how it was done. I thought it was the hardest thing I've ever been involved with just to make.
So that was Bill Simmons and Nick Khan talking about the Mr. McMahon series that got, I mean, there's probably an episode 7 on just the making of this documentary that would be really interesting if you got the relevant parties all together for this. But, that was kind of the extent of, any sort of like Vince McMahon discussion here, and moving on to many other various discussions about WrestleMania.
Can I overanalyze that comment for a moment? What does the word tawdry mean?
Probably doesn't really encompass the level. Really does reduce it to you know, this guy that you know, he just you know, he's
showy but cheap and of poor quality is what Google defines it as.
Okay. I don't know if I would read that. When I read that lawsuit, and I've read it several times now, I don't know if the word tawdry is what was my takeaway word from that complaint that was outlined. I mean, it's more so just interesting in that it's somewhat like we're approaching this from two fronts. It's on the one side, obviously, they are of the belief of we are protecting our brand. First and foremost, Vince McMahon has become extremely toxic to our brand. And we can talk about, oh, this is not factual, this is not true, these are allegations, while at the same time, Vince McMahon did not leave this company voluntarily. It was like at the core of this, let's be real here, is that Vince McMahon became very bad for our business, not just from a perception issue, but also from a day-to-day perspective. Like, there has been a value in WWE and TKO moving past Vince McMahon.
And him being removed from creative, not only the toxicity that he may have presented to sponsors.
Exactly. And I think there is both. Like, this, to me, I don't view this as some kind of, like, moral standing that we are moving away from Vince McMahon. I think if you were to look at another figure thrown into this, if this person were perceived as someone that we're going to die on the hill for, we would back against sponsor revolt. They did not. And then, you know, for this series to come out in the way that they did, I mean, it's like Nick Khan was very complimentary here towards Bill Simmons, who he certainly has a grand affinity for.
Grand affinity, yes.
I would say grand affinity. I am associating grand attached to it. I mean, he put, I mean, at one point, Bill Simmons even pushes back. He's like, you don't have to bring me into this. Let's just talk about you. Like, we don't need the, I mean, the charm offensive was a 12 on a scale of 1 to 10.
Compliments are currency is another thing I learned from this interview.
Yes, and I will never not have that Adnan Virk line in my head when I'm watching these. It's like, as Nick Khan once told me, don't answer the question they ask you. Answer the question you wish you were asked. And there was several of those examples.
This interview, not only are they sort of looking each other up and down at every opportunity, which is typical for these two, I think, in the previous interviews they've done. But there's in other comments, I think there are subtitles that are needed, and we will attempt to translate here. Do you speak Nick Khan?
I might after today. I definitely know what his go-to stories are, and relating things as though, you know, we have a saying around here, .. there's a lot of those. But
there's only one good fortune count in this interview.
If your job at a healthcare facility includes disinfecting against viruses, you know prevention is the best medicine. And maintaining healthy spaces starts with a healthy cleaning routine. Grainger's world-class supply chain helps ensure you have the quality products you need when you need them. From disinfectants and cleaning supplies to personal protective equipment, so you can help deliver a clean bill of health. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hackers don't need much. Just one leaked password can potentially unlock a treasure trove of personal information, leading to stress, pain, and permanently wrecked credit. Don't be an easy target. Get protection by Aura today. Aura protects your identity, finances, and family, all in one powerful app. Get real-time alerts, safeguard your accounts, and block scams before they happen. If identity theft strikes, we help you recover. Stay protected at aura.com/listen. That's aura.com/listen.
Your child has so much potential, but your local schools may not be right for them. Check out K-12. K-12 powered schools are accredited tuition-free online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
Well, let's get to the heart. Let's go to what is going to be ammunition and fuel for the wrestling podcast industry over the next 5 days, and that is Nick Khan subtly talking about AEW. Or let me rephrase that. It is the other pro wrestling organization, I think, as its official name. So here is Nick Khan. First of all, let's hear from him being asked, do you have a rival?
Do you feel like you have a rival? Because like 2 years ago, could make the case. Last year, it seemed like no. Now it just seems like you guys are all powerful again, and AEW is not a rival in the same way. They're kind of moment. Just, I have no dog in the race. I don't really care, but sure. It's just from afar, it seems like their moment came and gone, and they're like just firmly number two now.
Well, look, we're always the underdog at WWE. We always feel that people underestimate us, that mm-hmm. we're looked down upon, and we like it that way. In terms of the other wrestling promotional company, they have a lot of talented wrestlers, and we're happy about that. When contractually, you know, they're available to be, you know, talked to and have conversations with, assume a number of them will come over, and nothing but respect for the father who
That was way too nice.
Finances it and Jeez. Owns the Jaguars and all those other things.
That was very pleasant. Look at you.
That's it.
You're so magnanimous.
I'm 50 now, so different than when we were much younger.
All due respect, Bill Simmons. I mean, the shade that just flew right over Bill Simmons' head right there as he thought he was being complimentary yes. when it was like the ultimate dig at one Tony Khan was somewhat remarkable. Listen, I don't think anyone is going to argue the placement of the two pro wrestling companies that are based out of the United States. But to completely overlook, and this is more on Bill Simmons, I don't expect Nick Khan to be throwing out information to support AEW's cause, but to just overlook the fact that they just signed a seismic television deal that has pretty much borne out that this this startup is now set for the next number of years, that through all expectation levels drives them into profitability. I think it's just like Bill Simmons of just more so conveying his vibes towards AEW.
As far as their viability, that's a relevant point. Yeah.
But yeah, it's more so, this is more so going to be analyzed more so from the Nick Khan point of view, that I think he really enjoys, like just the subtle jabs that he takes and continually like positioning this, which a narrative just forms like this, as though this is this rich kid running a company that's financed by his dad, that he doesn't have to worry about making money, which if you want to throw that out, that's fine. But that's completely ludicrous at this point in time now, when this company, this is no longer just a deficit growth. It is a company that has now achieved what it set out to do with its television deal, I think, like that. But that narrative, I think, has taken hold with a large amount of the wrestling audience, and Nick Khan is more than willing to kind of just continually give oxygen to that, because it's a really easy way to minimize AEW in this marketplace as its top competitor in 24 years.
I agree with Bill Simmons' pretty, you know, condensed summary of what's happened with AEW, though, that it has become decidedly the number two. Its threat to WWE, which was greater a few years ago, is far less. It's far less. And a lot of that has to do with just Vince no longer being part of the creative process and the problems that alleviates. But yes, I think if there's something honest in there, I think Nick appreciates that Shad is a self-made, you know, billionaire and success story. He's kind of a classic case of the American dream of somebody who came over to the United States and had great business success. And I think Nick, to a degree, might relate with that. But it is, the subtitle is that, you know, we have great respect for the dad. The dad is funding his kid's thing and his kid's doing whatever. And, you know, they're probably not profitable, at least at this point. Although I think there's a good chance that they will become profitable, if not by this year, then soon after. But those are sort of it's clearly something that I believe Seth Rollins said something to the same degree, a billionaire's kid, this week. And it's something, it's a similar comment that Nick has made in the past, which leaves one to wonder if this is sort of it's a calculated decision, that there's been a discussion about this beforehand, about how we respond specifically to AEW and specifically to Tony Khan's place in the wrestling business, and how we can best say something that sounds kind of nice, but also diminishes him.
Is a kid running WWE talent relations right now?
Okay.
Because Tony Khan is older than Chris LaGentle, if we are assigning the term kid to these.
Yes, but Nick Khan and Chris LaGentle bonded over their mutual experience in public schools.
Yes. Yes. I mean, from the pizzeria to the public school system.
Yes.
We will get into the history of Chris LaGentle later, because there was a piece on him as well. Let's continue on this, because then we had Nick Khan also speaking a bit about the move of Cody Rhodes first leaving WWE in 2015, hitting the independents, and then, of course, again, you will never hear the letters AEW come out of this man's mouth. I mean, it's just like...
Simmons did say AEW at one point, but yes, they are...
Simmons, yes. Khan, not at all. It's just another wrestling company, but here's that answer.
To his credit, he's never really talked about what happened with those guys.
Yeah, he doesn't talk a lot of shit in a negative way, which is something I admire about him.
He moved on, and he's in a better spot. It felt like it probably got a little credit grabby over there. That was just knowing nothing, just from reading and following the breadcrumbs and reading stuff like Meltzer's newsletter and weird shit like that, where you're just like, it seems like there's a lot of people in this kitchen right now claiming that they cooked the pot roast.
You know this drill. I saw you do it at Grantland. I saw you do it when you replicated Grantland at the Ringer. Everyone knows who the founder is. You don't sit there saying, I did Spotify, the people who do that, I've never really seen them succeed.
Yeah.
I feel like the actual leaders, they're the ones, they'll take credit when something's a disaster, which you should as the leader of a company. When something is success, give credit to everybody else. It doesn't matter.
I give all credit to Brandon Thurston for the success of this show.
to what degree there is success. So I think you read that a number of ways, but I read that as he's talking about Tony Khan there. At least it fits my you know, impression of what's happening there. And I, you know, if you read weird shit like The Observer or, you know, or other bits of wrestling media, it seems very possible that a contributing reason why Cody Rhodes left AEW is because of maybe disagreements about power and control within AEW. And you know, I think Tony Khan does have a number of weaknesses as a leader. He's an inexperienced leader, and he's, I believe, shown to be underprepared and lacking in self-awareness. And many of the internal challenges that AEW face come down to that he isn't an experienced leader, that he doesn't seem to be very aware and doesn't even you know, seem to take accountability for the decline in AEW's popularity lately. And I think those are real things. And I think maybe Nick Khan is alluding to that.
I mean, they're absolutely trying to push this idea. And like you, what I took from this interview the most is that, and I think AEW absolutely takes up real estate in their overall projection. I don't think it's like this dominating topic that they're thinking about on a day-to-day basis, but I think it's very clear here that if you are someone that is maybe somewhat following AEW, or maybe not, maybe you're just aware of these letters, like they like to just kind of paint the perception, and there's truth to this and there's exaggeration to this, of a company that is funded by this billionaire whose kid is running it, who we will always label as a kid, that is dysfunctional behind the scenes. They bench talent. These are not serious people is basically what Nick Khan is trying to distill AEW into, whereas we are the major leagues. We are a well-run oiled machine, and we are where everyone aspires to come to. And just like,
is there truth to that?
I think there's elements of that. I don't for a second believe that WWE is just this seamless company that runs mm-hmm. without problems, but it's also ones that are greatly, they are analyzed in very different states. Like when we see a CM Punk exploding on a Hangman page on live television, it's a failure of leadership that such a personal issue comes onto the screen. But when a Charlotte Flair, Tiffany Stratton segment goes off the rails, it's like, that is like, oh, it's 4D chess that we're playing here. It's like, it's not always, you know, there's dysfunction in every company. There's plenty of talent in WWE that raise your hand about Sheamus's big program this weekend, or Andrade's big run that he's had since coming over from AEW. Like, I can go through many. There are talent that, just with the absence of live events, that are just like not wrestling for weeks, if not months anymore. This was Karrion Kross, who has had a presence on television, having his first match this week of the year. There's plenty of talent that you could look at WWE as like, yeah, you do bench talent. You absolutely do bench talent. That's just a reality of these giant rosters that these two companies have. And yeah, that's going to affect.
And I don't know if we're playing that clip, but this is the clip where Nick says that, he kind of goes out of his way to say that AEW benches the other guys' bench talent. We're something that we're not going to do because
I forgot we had this one. Let's hear it in context.
Yeah. We won't sign.
I think that happened in the past, though. Maybe before you,
perhaps. But we won't sign and bench people. You know, we sign people who we want to use.
I'm not saying bench people, but you sign somebody, and then within a couple weeks, you know, they're barely being used because you have too many people.
No, I'm saying if another entity signs and benches people now, like that's not something we would do.
Oh, because that is a thing that happens.
That's what I've been told from time to time. Not us.
Not awesome.
what a turnaround of Bill. Like, just, oh, I hear other entities do that. Not us. I was like, I don't know about that. I don't know if every single talent is.
Would that be the New England Patriots? Who's he talking about there?
Yeah, I don't know. Other entities bench others. But again, like that is Nick Khan communicating to looming free agents. Like, come over here, the grass is greener, and we will not take you for granted. You will get your minutes, you will get your exposure. This is the place everyone aspires to be. And listen, with WWE on this hot streak, like, you are talking about a generation of wrestlers who grew up post WCW that WrestleMania is like, that is the validation of being on a WrestleMania card. It is not, you do not have talent that have grown up where All In is the validation point of your career. And they're leaning on that. I think extremely heavily. And AEW, it has also risen the floor for a lot of these salaries in that, you know, we can talk about UFC and the fighter compensation. WWE does not have that luxury yet because there is this alternative that will spend money, and it does force you to have to be very competitive with your contracts, with having a strong, at least a viable number two in the marketplace.
Yeah, and I think there is a motivation to some extent, warehouse talent, to keep talent, because it's not just a benefit for you to use them, but to keep them away from your competitor. And it may be something that WWE was doing a number of years ago, even more so. But I do think that is an element with both. I mean, do you have an impression like to proportionately, because they almost have the same number of wrestlers, although they have different hours of TV at this point. Is it more of an issue of great talent being unused or talent being unused more so in AEW than WWE?
I'd really be interested to like just going off my just top of my head, I would state that you're like, as I list off like these names for WWE, it's like I can make a case for people that are just, and for whatever reasons, like we get very little in terms of, like, you know, injuries are kept exceptionally quiet. So sometimes is someone being used or not used because of injury, because of just there's no creative for them on both sides. You can look at that.
Someone brings up Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar has been benched. Yeah, for some reason.
He's doing his thing. He's just doing his thing.
But there aren't there aren't the Miro cases and the Ricky Starks cases. And I would put Britt Baker in that category now of just, they've not been used for months and months not for an injury reason.
Yeah. I mean, you have a lot of just the disappearing acts in AEW, like Private Party, lose these tag titles, have not been seen since. Britt Baker is a big one as well. And it would be interesting to look at both rosters and sort of the infrequency of matches. Maybe that's a future scraping that we can.
Oh, there's a script for that. We've done that before.
Okay. Some other notes from the interview. I mean, he did talk about the fact about presenting a lot of their premium live events over holiday weekends, because internationally, 4th of July is not something to avoid, nor is Labor Day. Imagine running a big show over Labor Day weekend.
Yeah, that's something that AEW has done. Yeah.
He also, I mean, more and more, we do get some of Nick Khan's, his opinions towards, I guess, the culture, and how it is shifting, and the fact that, you know, I grew up at a time where in LA, you used to just let people live their own lives. And
people could have two wives simultaneously if they want.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I don't think if anyone, listen, if you're not a, if you don't believe
Nick Khan is open-minded to polygamy, okay?
He is very open to polygamy is what I took away from this, and says that UFC has not shifted from that, whereas LA has shifted a little bit from that. It's just more so interesting that we just, I don't know, that's like your whole other can of worms. But he did make like the observation about like this last election cycle, that you had one candidate that was speaking to you, the voter, and the other side that was just saying, don't vote for this guy. And I mean, there is some merit in that. I don't know if the timing is really great to be, you know, this one candidate really had you in mind, as you are.
Let's talk about the Canadian election, right?
I'm sure he was talking about Mark Carney, yes, and Pierre Poilievre. But, you know, at a time like you do kind of – like Bill Simmons, I think, did not want to really talk about like the political injection. But that's – to me, it's a real astonishing one to watch the UFC and WWE's, you know, handling of a very politicized climate, one that has so leaned into it and another that has been very, very much away from it. Although you are seeing, at least at the higher end, like a Paul Levesque that we'll get to a little later on, not having that reticence to make it very clear of, you know, their opinions of the president and what potential reaction your fan base will have to it. We know what the UFC fan reaction is to it, but a WWE fan base, I think, is much more sensitive to that than the MMA audience.
Yeah, I also think there's just a certain amount of ambivalence and indifference. It's that it's what they're doing to this point, and I think we're going to play the clip from Paul Levesque about Donald Trump, but I don't think they're greatly affecting their business, their fan base. They're not telling the people who are paying attention anything that they don't already suspect, I think. And I don't know that they're changing consumer behavior by doing that. On the other hand, I don't know why you would play with fire when you've already got, you know, when you've already been apolitical for so long and politics have become so polarizing and toxic.
And the final thing I just wanted to note is that, man, did Nick Kahn just get on a rant about what he called the biggest scam he ever observed. And that was cable operators taking anywhere from 30 to 60% of pay-per-view revenue. And he said that having getting away from pay-per-view and into streaming, that consistent subscribership got them away from the volatility of month-to-month pay-per-views and then just torpedoed DirecTV, which he is still a customer of, but just is disgusted by the customer service at DirecTV. Imagine being a DirecTV representative and telling Nick Kahn that, you know, we can't get out there today.
Well, it's a distressed business.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's Nick Kahn's state of the media business.
For what it's worth, I mean, you can find political contributions that Nick Kahn has made on the FEC website, and he's only given to Democrats, for what it's worth.
Well, that's interesting. He did not disclose who he voted for, nor does he have to. Not a requisite. Paul Levesque, how many Democratic donations has Paul Levesque made?
None. I think his latest one that I've seen was way back in like 2015 to who is the former governor of New Jersey.
What's Chris that guy's Christie?
Name? Yes, Chris Christie.
Well, there you have it. By the way, we didn't even mention off the top. This is a wonderful graphic that Brandon created. I'm just curious if you used any A1 technology to.
Yeah, I don't use A1 technology. I do use A1 technology. Well, I use AI technology to help me code, to tell me what to do and fix my problems, but not for visuals themselves. Those are written with Python scripts that I make myself.
Or I'm surprised I'm surprised it basically took a decade of Linda McMahon in Trump world to.
By the way, what is a taco? What is a taco? A burrito.
A burrito.
Didn't Vince not know what a burrito was?
It was that part of the same discussion?
No, Vince doesn't know what a burrito is.
Oh, anyway. I see. That one, sorry. That went right over my head like Bill Simmons earlier. Well, here you go. Let's hear a bit from Paul Levesque, who was on with Andrew Schultz, who was recently in the front row at Raw. This guy did like a near 3-hour sit down with Paul Levesque.
Yeah.
And here is Paul Levesque, the man who spent New Year's Eve at Mar-a-Lago.
Like, I can feel the heat.
Okay. I'm a big believer. It's funny that Nick Kahn, who's the president of the company, with me.
Shout out Nick. I like Nick, man.
He's the best. Yeah, he's absolutely great. The best. Like, he's really, I couldn't do this without him, but like, he's the best. But he always has this thing with like, the most charismatic guy wins. Doesn't matter. Hmm. Doesn't matter your policy. Doesn't matter anything. Whoever the most charismatic guy is in the debates wins. Mm-hmm. And you can historically look at that and
yeah,
pretty accurate, right? And I think Trump's ability as an orator, as like him or hate him, the way he does it.
Yeah.
But he's charismatic in so many ways. And like, I think he likes getting under people's skin. I think he likes generating.
I mean, he plays a great heel
the way he does. Yeah. It's amazing and it's genius. And it worked in our business. Do I think he got that from our business? I think he innately understands that. It's been his whole life.
Mm-hmm.
You think about that. Like, why there's a lot of billionaires in the world, I suppose. And why was he the most famous one? Why was he the one that was in People magazine every week and, you know, with everybody under the sun? Why was he seen as the epitome of that, you know, that billionaire sort of status and all that stuff because of his charisma and his character and who he is and the way he can speak about it and do all those things. He just captivates people. And I think it's why he is where he is.
I didn't know that sending people to prisons in El Salvador, that's great heel heat. Great heel.
That's all it is. It's all, you know, harmless fun.
The most charismatic guy always wins. So, I guess Joe Biden, in fact, the most charismatic politician in 2020.
That one does stand out as the exception, right? I guess you could say, let's see, Obama more charismatic than McCain or Romney. Trump more charismatic than Hillary. W more charismatic than Kerry or Gore. That's probably fair.
Jimmy Carter was not a charismatic president.
Who did Jimmy Carter beat? This is before my time.
Carter
would have beaten Ford?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, sure.
But only got 4 years. Maybe that's it. The less charismatic.
Well, Reagan came along and beat him.
Reagan was super charismatic. I mean, I don't even disagree with like the premise. Like Donald Trump, like for all you want to say, like his charisma has been something that has overcome. I mean, how many landmines that would have sunk other politicians that he is this magnetic personality. I mean, I don't even disagree with that. But I was just more interested in the fact that, you know, listen, I just watched the UFC pay-per-view, which was essentially just the latest RNC retreat on Saturday. And it's just commonplace at this point. And then I hear this comment come out and you just have like your WWE audience that, again, granted, it's a small sample size, I'm sure, of the overall. But like you see way more outrage towards like just Paul Levesque just speaking about Donald Trump than you would like the other wing of the company that is like a wing of the Republican Party. It's like I'm not here to like, you know, police people's politics and such. It's more so just interesting to see you have very different fan bases, I think, at the core, and a WWE audience that is way more, I think, averse to their leadership being open about their politics.
I mean, Nick characterized UFC as, well, it just so happens that Dana is friends with Trump, and they're really welcoming to everybody. Would you say that is a fair characterization of the current UFC audience and product?
There is not a chance in hell that Joe Biden would have been welcome at a UFC pay-per-view. He would have been welcome at a UFC pay-per-view. There's no way he's getting a walkout.
What I'm saying is does a prospective UFC fan who disagrees with Donald Trump's politics, do they feel just as comfortable becoming a UFC fan as they would in some other case if Trump wasn't so associated and Republican politics weren't so associated with UFC?
I think that there is definitely an audience that is turned off by this a lot, but I think a lot of that audience has sort of been weeded out, and it's more than been replaced by the audience that loves this. Like, you literally have people showing up at these cards dressed as Donald Trump.
It's defining an identity. It's defining
like,
a brand,
it is like, and it, and don't get it like messed up either. Like, this is, yes, it's a great endorsement for the UFC in terms of their perception to have this level of attention. It's also very valuable that coming off this horrific week for the Republican Party, that they come to what is essentially the extension of a rally and a sold out arena that's going wild for this whole administration. Like, there was a PR exercise in play on Saturday night as well that was equally, if not more, beneficial to these politicians just to be seen and attached to a crowd of approval when the approval ratings of this president had tanked 20 points during the week and people watching their 401ks go up in smoke. So, I mean, this is very interdependent, I think, that you have between these two. And, one that has been, you know, this has been the case since 2016.
Yeah. I don't think Donald Trump is going to be showing up to WrestleMania, though, anytime soon. He doesn't seem to lean into the WWE stuff as much as he's although, you know, hiring Linda McMahon to run education, but much more interested in UFC and even Gable Steveson, amateur wrestling.
That's right. That's right. Well, maybe he'll make the trifecta from the NCAAs to UFC, and it'd be an interesting reaction to see. I was there at Madison Square Garden, the Hall of Fame, and man, he got booed out of that building in 2013.
2013. Yeah,
that was in the middle of that was post like all the birther stuff as well. So I mean, he was not as didn't quite have the popularity.
I've heard that Grande Americano is now from the Gulf of Mexico, though. So I don't know if I think he would have to oppose that.
Oh, he might. The Associated Press will weigh in on that one. Let's chat a bit about. We spoke about this. Sports Business Journal did a profile on Chris LaGentle, and I think it was an interesting article to look at of someone who is, I think for a lot of people, they know the name Chris LaGentle, but I think he's so associated on the PR front in WWE and not enough focus on the dual role he has as your head of talent relations as well. And this article, it kind of is focusing, like, you have comments here from Nick Khan, from Cody Rhodes, from Paul Levesque. This was a very glowing piece on Chris LaGentle as, you know, positioning him as like one of their key people behind the scenes that has these roles, and coming from humble beginnings, him and Nick Khan having in common, they both went to they went through the public school system. And I learned that, much like Chris LaGentle, him and I also have common roots, working at a pizza place.
You worked at a pizza place.
I worked at a movie theater at the Pizza Hut inside the movie theater. So you know what?
Did you go to public school?
No, I went to Catholic school, so wow. I missed out on that. You know what? I went for literally one semester to a public high school and then transferred back. So I got a snapshot of a public school in high school.
I went to public school and public college, and I did have a very brief run at a pizzeria.
Look at that. I mean, the pizzeria, it's what brings the whole world together.
It's the American dream.
What did you think about the article and just overall, Chris LeGentil's role in this company that, you know, it is, he was a DAZN hire and kind of presented in this like a protege of Nick Khan that has been handed a lot of responsibility and tasking him a lot with like the credit for obtaining some of these site fees that they have now, Sports Business Journal even notes from a source are routinely eclipsing $1 million per event when they're found.
So I think it's about a year ago that we realized that I think I saw a quote from Chris LeGentil in an article that cited him as an EVP. And then we learned that he's in charge of talent relations in addition to being in charge of PR. And my impression is that PR is not usually an area where there's a lot of growth potential beyond that department, but he's clearly getting into another department too and doing both of those roles at the same time. It's made me wonder, you know, if Nick Khan were to get attracted to become an executive at another company, which you could see happening, who would take over the Nick Khan role?
Maybe or even in the immediate, Brandon, with like with the boxing, you know, being a major thing on his plate about, LeGentil's role increasing that much more.
And clearly Mark Shapiro is, at least to the investors and to the big bank conferences, Mark Shapiro is there too.
Yeah. So it's an interesting article just to look at in terms of, his positioning here and, you know, someone as well that has been put out more and more in the media.
Over, he saw him do an interview with Richard Deutsch. Year.
Yes.
He's done a few other. He's been going on the record as and being attributed by name, which is a new thing within the last year or so.
Let's continue on. We'll talk about some AEW news and notes because they have had a couple of announcements over the past couple of days. We have two nights in Boston at the Fenway Music Hall, beginning tonight with their spring breakthrough, as they will break past the number of episodes Monday Nitro produced.
Is that happening tonight?
Yes, tonight is episode 289, followed by a live collision on Thursday night. And today they announced AEW Grand Slam Mexico in cooperation with CMLL that will happen Wednesday night, June the 18th at Arena Mexico. This will be the first AEW branded event in the country of Mexico and should be one of the hottest crowds.
The first non-CMLL EMLL show ever probably in Arena Mexico, right?
Yeah. Like this is like it's owned and operated by CMLL and you'll get CMLL talent. Like they're right there on the poster with Místico. I mean, this is going to be, I do feel like this, it is a midweek event. I'd be a little more high on this if it were a weekend event, but I think you're absolutely going to get people traveling for this show. Like for, just the crowd itself should be electric and just based on this will be much like the Grand Slam Australia show, I think built up to be a really big show. And I would imagine you do collision on top of it, like just get two very hot crowds for that week.
I hope there are air horns. Will you be going to Mexico City for this?
Listen, I saw this. I was like, I would be more intrigued to go to this show than many others. I've never been to Arena Mexico. This would be a good excuse to do it. So we shall see. Maybe we could do it a show live on location at Arena Mexico that day.
If they'll give us space, I'm open to it.
We could look at that. Forbidden Door has been officially confirmed for the O2 Arena August 24th in London. We knew the date, we knew the city, and we basically knew the arena. But with WWE running the O2 Arena for two dates on their European tour, this seemed like one of the typical restrictions. They couldn't officially announce this until after the WWE had completed their tour. So now we know the O2 Arena for Forbidden Door, which at this point won't likely feature Tetsuya Naito, which won't feature Jeff Cobb, and we're not even going to get Bushi at Forbidden Door. It would seem like it.
Yeah, so I was shocked by this news. Not the O2, but that Naito is leaving New Japan. What's he going to do? Is he just going to be a freelancer?
There was a time that and Nakamura I think timed this out really well in terms of
he's going to WWE.
No, I don't think Naito should go to WWE.
He's 50 at this point, right?
Yeah. Like, this to me would be someone that a few years ago, like, you can see, like,
oh, he's only where 42. He's only 42. Okay.
He's 42, but his body is 52. And yes. He has dramatically, like, reduced his output, and it's stuck out in a very significant way. He's had the
he's recurring, even more tranquilo than usual.
I mean, he's had to pretty much have yearly surgeries on his eye. To me, it's too late in his career to even go to WWE, where he could work at a reduced rate and he would still have the charisma. If I was WWE, I just don't think the value is there to sign a 42-year-old. Granted, Jeff Cobb is 42, but I think you have more in the tank for a Jeff Cobb than you do a Naito, who would have to uproot himself at this stage in his career. I just see Naito going freelance and doing, shows that are of interest to him. Like, that's what I see as the outlook for Naito, rather than a big move that would have been more ideal 5 years ago for Naito.
And Bushi is going with him.
Yeah.
Just somebody who's aligned with Naito.
You would think like they're going to be a package deal where they go. But what New Japan is losing here is like their biggest merch unit is LIJ, and LIJ without Naito is a big, big gap. And like the idea 3 years ago, Brandon, that we're talking about a New Japan without Tanahashi, without Naito, without Okada, even to a lesser degree, like without Kota Ibushi, Osprey gone, Omega gone. Like this is like the immediate, like this will be a hit to New Japan, that whatever your thought is of Naito's like deterioration in the ring, he is among it. You could argue still their biggest star, just from a like merchandise standpoint and the longevity he's had in this company. And you're getting the 1-2 punch of losing Tanahashi and now Naito this year.
It would be fair to say that, I mean, both of the Bushiroad wrestling companies and Stardom has taken a hit. Obviously they've lost Julia. That's the one that I'm familiar with, that most people would be familiar with, but it seems like both of them have really taken a hit in terms of popularity, in terms of talent.
Yeah. Like New Japan is very much in this rebuilding phase. And the problem with that is that you may get the talent that they are situated in Japan, they don't want to leave, but a lot of these talents that you're building up, once they reach a certain level, the big two are going to come calling, and it's going to be very hard for some of these talents to look at, like there's no way they can compete financially with the offers and the continued perception that to make it, it's not work in the Tokyo Dome, it is going to headline WrestleMania, or it's going to work for AEW. And I think that's, and it's not a case of just, even if you're a native Japanese star, like that is not going to preclude you as from going over, and you're not going to see these lifers sticking around in the company. It's like the projections for New Japan is like, this is kind of going to be a recurring story of talent that's going to either want out or that you're going to have to break the bank to retain and keep. And that's going to be very difficult. Or best case is these dual contracts that you have with like a Konosuke Takeshita or a Kevin Knight, where they split their time between AEW and WWE and New Japan rather.
Yeah. Well, as long as Eugene God is there, I've got hope.
Well, Dwayne Johnson might come in and save the day.
That's right. I've heard.
What does that Rubik's Cube mean, Brandon?
What is he going to buy New Japan?
Yeah, maybe he's maybe Naito's going to the UFL. Has anyone suggested that?
Because The Rock is involved with the UFL.
Has to be the Rubik's Cube. What is behind this whole equation? But yeah, that was a very big story dropping today with the exit of Tetsuya Naito and Bushi. With Naito and Bushi expected to wrap up in May, in just a couple of weeks. And to get like the timing out here, like Bushi had just been announced for the Best of the Super Juniors next month, so he's out of the tournament. And obviously, they did not expect to be. No, Jeff Cobb and Bushi, I don't think, and Naito, that this was expected, even with Naito's deal up. But yes, they've also announced AEW that they will, when they go over to England, they're going to be doing a dual Dynamite and Collision from Glasgow, Scotland, in the days leading up to it on August the 20th.
Yes.
What is our latest, Brandon, on the Ryan Nemeth lawsuit against AEW and CM Punk?
No longer a public lawsuit, unfortunately. There were filings that appeared on the docket, the federal docket on Monday, which made me go and check the state docket where Ryan Nemeth filed his lawsuit. And it looks like the wheels were in motion last Friday to voluntarily dismiss this lawsuit, as it appears. Well, according to, it doesn't just appear, but according to Ryan Nemeth's attorney, who told us that there's been no settlement, but they have agreed to take this dispute to arbitration, which means we've all been learning here what arbitration means. It means it goes away into private. There's no public court. There's no public filings. So it's quite possible that we will learn very little about what happens with this dispute going forward. There'll be presumably a third party mediator who will interact with both parties and try to help them resolve this dispute.
Is this going to be a representative from JAMS Inc.?
I assume something will involve JAMS, which is the arbitration organization that's referred to in the talent contracts.
Well, I'm very disappointed that this case is going behind closed doors. I mean, this had the potential to be the most entertaining public case. I mean, for a lot of like ugly cases that we follow, this could have been a relatively entertaining one.
Yes, with all of Ryan Nemeth's various allegations and photos of Tony Khan. I would think the strategy here is, now remember, AEW responded to this lawsuit, not in LA state level court where it was filed, but in federal court in Florida, saying we want a judge to order that this needs to go to arbitration, citing the arbitration clause in his talent contract and in all three of his talent contracts purportedly. And not only that, but they said, we want you to order this into arbitration and to order that this has to, that he has to pay the attorney's fees for us having to do this in federal court. And I imagine to avoid additional legal costs that might have helped convince the Nemeth side to go into arbitration.
I was also interested because I have not had a chance to see this yet. You did. We had Gerard Mallette appearing on Wrestling with the Devil with Lee Cole. And this was interesting because of the fact that Gerard Mallette, for those that are not familiar, he is someone that has been a staunch defender of Mel Phillips and Lee Cole, anything but. And they put up this conversation. It was about 40 minutes. It is a members only video on his channel, so most are not going to have access to watch this. It was the first part of this. Was there anything revelatory that came out of this, Brandon, or anything new that was maybe not known beforehand? Because it was just more so interesting, the fact that the two sides that have had extremely opposing views to one another did this interview together.
Yeah. Just real quick, I know you put it on the screen, but Bix has pointed out that there have been non-CML shows at Arena Mexico, including the Dragon Mania shows. So just make sure we get
we will always
there.
Fact check ourselves. Thank you, Bix.
Thank you, Bix. This was a fascinating conversation. I don't know if there's any new information that came out of it. As you said, we've interacted with Gerard Mallette as somebody who really defends Mel Phillips. He's the person who has been referred to at the time as Mrs. Mel Phillips because he was so close to Mel Phillips. And we've had Lee on here, who's very much a defender of the Ring Boys, who alleged that they were sexually abused as children by Mel Phillips in the 80s. This was a more civil conversation than I expected, although Gerard was pressed pretty hard about why he defends Mel Phillips and to be, he's being pushed to be more open-minded about the allegations in the Ring Boy lawsuit, but at least they were somewhat civil.
We have also had lighter stories here. WWE and Fanatics have been rolling out announcements this week. You can add this to your library of podcasts to listen to. What Do You Want to Talk About? Hosted by Cody Rhodes, which will be a bi-weekly show presented by Wheatley Vodka. And just announced about an hour ago, WWE and Fanatics has announced the launch of What's Your Story? Hosted by WWE icon Steph McMahon. Abbreviated Steph. Is that the rebranding?
This is in addition to her TV show.
Yes, yes. This is a podcast with new episodes debuting every other week. The first episode of What's Your Story premieres Thursday, April 17th, and will feature UFC president and CEO Dana White.
Can't wait.
No, I can't wait at all.
How can I subscribe now?
I don't know. Probably search for Wheatley Vodka, and I'm sure it will direct you to our biweekly What's Your Story mixed in with What Do You Want to Talk About with Cody Rhodes. So look at that, trying to impede on our space.
It's interesting to see. This is Stephanie's role as kind of an ambassador for the company, not an executive.
Steph. Okay.
Excuse me.
Steph. So there you have it. Your latest announcements there. And that kind of brings us to a close. Is there anything else you wanted to discuss before we wrap things up? I think we did a pretty good job of getting to all of these topics here.
I think we got all of it. Anything else?
We had just our regular kind of ratings pattern for the last couple of days.
It's notable that now we're 2 weeks into WWE being on Netflix in India. There's been no noticeable effect.
No,
despite that country's an immense population and fandom for WWE, but it's maybe just the case that not that many people have Netflix in India.
Yeah, second week in India, and this was also the first time that it did not rank in the top 10 in Canada, which was this was for a week ago Monday, so not this past Monday's show, but a week ago. Whether that's noteworthy or not, it was the first time they didn't finish in the top 10 there. But I mean, it was kind of a standard number otherwise as they're going into WrestleMania week. All right. Well, we're going to sign off, but Brandon and I will be back next week to chat about all the fallout of WrestleMania weekend. And for all you roast goers, John at postwrestling.com for a blow-by-blow account would be greatly appreciated. I know you probably won't have access to your phones, but I know we have a spirited bunch out there of people. Hey, the pen and paper, non-digital tools that can be your best friend.
If nothing else, there's your memory he can use too.
That's it. So we look forward to that coming up this weekend. We will be doing WrestleMania coverage all week long at postwrestlingcafe.com. If you want to go back this week, I put up a show going through the business notes, highs and lows of every single WrestleMania from 1985 up until 2024. That is up on the cafe, and we'll be doing live shows on the cafe starting Thursday at noon Eastern time. The Thursday show we'll put on the free tier for everybody, and then the remainder you can check out. $6 a month gets you in the door for 30 days of access, and then we'll be live Saturday and Sunday night as soon as the show ends. With Saturday night, I'll be joined by Neil Flanagan, and Sunday night by the father of two himself, Wei Ting. So a big congratulations.
Oh, Wei is coming back.
Wei Ting, one night only. Okay. He is our Roman Reigns, okay? He's coming in for the big show, and then he's taken off. The night after WrestleMania, he's out. Part-timer waiting. But yes, that is all this week. And Brandon, over at WrestleNomics, he is reinventing the game, and we have got some incredible charts to break down all of your viewership data.
As first, the news was broken here first a few weeks ago, the transition from Matplotlib to Data Wrapper is complete, and our almost daily TV ratings reports on the various wrestling shows that air, and then we get data for them, not just TV ratings data, but the most in-depth TV ratings data you'll probably find anywhere, as well as we're analyzing the attendance data that comes out of it, the YouTube data, and a little bit of cage match data as well. We have completed that transition. There are some free samples out there, I believe, and subscribers get it every single wrestling show.
Any WrestleMania viewing expected from you this coming weekend?
I'll put it on the TV probably.
Okay. Well,
the weather's not supposed to be that good this weekend anyway.
Well, a happy Easter to everyone this coming weekend, wherever you are celebrating, if you acknowledge Easter or not. But we will be back next Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. So thanks to everyone for joining us, and have a great week.
If your job at a healthcare facility includes disinfecting against viruses, you know prevention is the best medicine. And maintaining healthy spaces starts with a healthy cleaning routine. Grainger's world-class supply chain helps ensure you have the quality products you need when you need them. From disinfectants and cleaning supplies to personal protective equipment, so you can help deliver a clean bill of health. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Location, the lab. Quentin only has 24 hours to sell his car. Is that even possible? He goes to Carvana.com.
What is this, a movie trailer?
He ignores the doubters, enters his license plate. Wow, that's a great offer. The car is sold, but will Carvana pick it up in time for...
They'll literally pick it up tomorrow morning. Done with the dramatics?
Car selling in record time.
Save your time. Go to Carvana.com and sell your car today. Pickup fees may apply.